on this episode of The Kinked Wire.
I'm a firm believer in technology, and I think that we can engineer our way out of pretty much everything in the world. And so my hope is that eventually we will listen to the engineers.
Welcome to The Kinked Wire, the interventional radiology podcast from SIR Publications. You can learn more on our website, surweb.org/kinkedwire. In this episode, host Roger Tomahama speaks with interventional radiologist Julius Shapiro about the future of artificial intelligence in interventional radiology, his work with AI and liver cancer treatment, and more.
Julius, thank you for taking time out to joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I know that you have a lot of expertise in artificial intelligence, and we wanted to get your take on it. And so first, how did you become interested in artificial intelligence?
Basically, it all started with my research that was not entirely focused on that. Like, my PhD background is actually in cancer immunology and molecular cell biology. But then when I did my postdoctoral fellowship in interventional oncology at Johns Hopkins, I understood really quickly that the future of IR advanced research is actually in data science and data analysis. And I was doing a lot of image analysis, really conventional stuff that, you know, is known from image post-processing, image analysis, and biomedical engineering. It's the bread and butter. And I quickly understood that the amount of data that we put through is going to grow rapidly. And then after a while, when I came back to Yale, where I originally did my PhD thesis, when I came back to Yale in 2016, I was incredibly fortunate to be paired up in research with our really fascinating group of biomedical engineers here. I've now become secondarily appointed in biomedical engineering and started working with our biomedical engineers on writing grants and putting together, you know, more advanced research with focus on liver cancer and image-guided therapies of liver cancer. And there, I was just much more exposed to all of this. And one of the people that certainly opened my eyes to all of this is James Duncan. I would call him one of the founding fathers of American image analysis. He's been in this for close to 40 years now. He's now the chair of biomedical engineering here. And, you know, he and I have written now many grants together, two NIH grants, two R01s. And all of the work that we do essentially has a data analysis component that uses advanced artificial intelligence, deep learning algorithms, really, to make sense of the data that we collect, first with focus on image guidance and tumor response analysis, and now more recently on immunotherapy combinations, locoregional therapies. And that is the background of my exposure. So I got into it with time. It was not my, you know, first specialty. And I would not say that, you know, compared to true biomedical engineers, I'm an expert. I would say that I'm more sophisticated end user than average. That's how I would call myself at best.
Okay. You know, I think very similar to you, our research team has done the same thing. We've really dabbled into the AI world, but kind of similar to you, I think, as on the back, looking at the clinical questions and seeing the potential. Obviously, it's a great setup that you have at your institution with the individuals you have. It sounds like it's a great thing. As radiologists, we predominantly see AI imaging playing a really significant role in the diagnostic radiology world. Do you foresee AI playing the same or growing to the same level extent in the interventional radiology realm?
It's a difficult question. So, I mean, in diagnostic radiology, obviously the workflows are clear. I mean, the major task of a diagnostic radiologist is image interpretation, so data analysis and pattern recognition and interpretation. So there it seems as though artificial intelligence has a pretty clear use case. In interventional radiology, the use case isn't as clear yet, isn't it? So at this point, what we're trying to do is to find really good applications to help us get more effective with our therapies. I do think that an interventional radiologist with focus on, for example, cancer therapies and interventional oncologists is going to benefit significantly from modern tools that will have decision-making support in a tumor board setting, that will have image interpretation support, and that will also have image guidance support for tumor coverage, interprocedural navigation guidance support, but also workflow support for patient follow-up. So I think we will have a pretty significant portion of our tasks assisted by AI, but I don't think that we will at any point in time reach a level of automation or reach a level of decision-making support similar to diagnostics.
Yeah.
Maybe in robotics, we're going to benefit from it the most, but I just don't foresee at this point in time that there's going to be ever a conversation, and it didn't materialize in diagnostic radiology, but in IR, I don't foresee a conversation ever to happen on us being replaced by AI, quote unquote.
Yeah, I think that's probably very true. I remember I was talking to some of my classmates in business school. Like, I think a lot of them are in AI in clinical, like like robotics. I know one individual was there, and I think some other clinicians were saying they were using AI. Like I know a gastroenterologist said they were using it for endoscopies and stuff, but it didn't seem like it was, you know, it was more supportive, like a computer-aided check for whatever they're doing rather than right. actual doing the procedure. But yeah, that's interesting. I definitely see so much more applications in the diagnostic world, and it's hard to see it doing an angio and running yeah. the AI algorithm as you're, you know, doing stuff, but that's interesting. Yeah.
Right.
I read one of your recent papers in AJR looking at machine model learning for predictions of post-treatment recurrence for looking at the pre-treatment parameters and imaging
yep.
for tumor outcomes. That was great work. What direction do you see you and your in the future in AI? Is it you think you're going to stay in the clinical outcomes realm for liver cancer, or do you see combining that with genomic data?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I mean, we recently got an NIH R1 funded on developing biomarkers for combination therapies between immunotherapy and local regional therapies. And right mm-hmm. now what we're doing, I mean, that paper that you mentioned in AJR, that really did the first step. It created a pipeline for marrying clinical data, lab parameters, and, you know, clinical performance scores in liver cancer patients with imaging outcome and imaging data at baseline to predict recurrence in patients with early stage HCC. Mm-hmm. And it was less so about the data, it was more so about the pipeline. And I think what we're doing right now is focusing on trying to find targetable mutations, but also doing advanced pathological analysis, and then trying to predict the way how, you know, the tumor microenvironment looks like, how the inflammatory state of the tumor looks like, just based on imaging.
Yeah.
And I think that's very powerful, because in HCC, obviously, the major issue is that in advanced stages, we don't frequently have tissue. LIRETS 5 is an amazing tool, but it also prevents us from, you know, biopsying every tumor. Doesn't really prevent us. It's just a high risk to biopsy every single HCC. And so luckily we know what, you know, when we see one, when it's meets the LIRETS 5 criteria, but we don't have tissue. And these tumors eventually get all treated with immunotherapies. And as you know, only about 20%, 25% at max of these patients respond. And right now we have over 50 trials investigating different combinations with immunotherapies and local regional therapies. And I think it is of great value to look at our ability to predict the inflammatory phenotype of these tumors based on imaging. And I think we have an opportunity right now. The world of pathology is getting digitalized. We have a digital pathology for the first time ever, where we can have a super high resolution scan slides of tumors and biopsies, and can do spatial analysis and spatial transcriptomics on that tissue. And then we can marry that information with really rich imaging information that we have now learned to deal with and try to better understand that disease. And, you know, I'm all about liver cancer, but I think that the pipelines and the ideas that we develop in this framework are going to be beneficial for also other diseases. And specifically then we'll give interventional oncologists the possibility to no longer just making educated guesses, but actually having real machine learning based data for decision support on whether or not we should do a combination and what kind of combination, you know, to
Yeah. I looked at your paper. We actually use the same VGT16 model in our CNN models for me and my wife do research for she's a vascular surgeon. So we've been doing work with triple NA analysis. And so it was so funny when I was like, oh my God, it's the same. We use transfer learning and just use a pre-trained neural network and developed our algorithm to detect it. And we were actually working on the very same concept. We were actually taking clinical data to, well, first we used like different like logistic regression, random forest models, just to analyze the preclinical data as a predictor. And now we're trying to marry it with the CNN model. And I think it's so interesting that we had the same neural network, you know, base. So what other interventional radiology groups have been working with AI in the IR world? Do you know of any other groups that are working on specific cool things?
Yeah, so it's actually quite interesting. You know, my first paper on that topic that we published actually in 2018, I think in JVIR with Aaron Abazian. He's currently a fellow at the Memorial Sloan Kettering. We published that paper in 2018. It was like an innocent cohort of 39 patients. And we investigated the use of logistic regression and simple random forests and, and like about 40 patients who underwent TACE and to predict the response to TACE. And what happened was that this paper got cited like 150 times within 2 years or so. And as I was reviewing some of these papers and folks that are citing us, I actually discovered so many different groups that are focusing on very similar stuff. And I also have to say, so the vast majority of that kind of research is actually originating in China right now, because they have really large data sets and large cohorts and large numbers of patients in HCC that they can actually effectively put through into those algorithms. I mean, obviously the Piggy Lab at Penn is doing a lot of work. There are some folks at Brown, formerly Hopkins Brown, that are doing similar research with focus on that. I think that people all across the country are starting to get into it. And, you know, I receive emails from residents and fellows who are asking me how to get started and what kind of research to do, how many patients do they need to get started, what they need to know, what they need to learn. And it's really coming to a point where a lot of people are trying to get into it. People in Europe, folks in Germany, in France, you know, team up between radiologists, interventional radiologists, and pathologists, and are doing pretty advanced such research. So I think we're going to see much more of that. And I'm very lucky because I am on several editorial boards, both in radiology and radiology AI and Journal of Hepatology. And I receive many of these papers and publications. And the quality over the last, I'd say like 2 years has increased significantly. I mean, from the early works where you basically just do a simple prediction on two small data sets with one viva cross-validation and then just predict something and, you know, have like no explanation for why it does what it does that was early stuff. Right now we have people playing around with interpretable explainable AI with like really advanced heat maps, with like really advanced generative AI with synthetic image design, and, you know, cool stuff that I am really amazed by. And so I'm very optimistic. I'm just not as hyped about it, because I think while the research is really evolving, you know, it's hard for me just right now to see many products that are going to be with us in a short term, probably midterm. Yes.
Yeah. Obviously, one of the challenges with what we do is that we can't amass like million patient data sets because of HIPAA, and there's no registry that stores all this data because all the hospitals have their own PAC system that are HIPAA compliant. Yeah. You know, do you feel that there's a way to like get all this data into common area that's, you know, HIPAA compliant? But I feel like now there's, you know, all these great patient sets that are hospital isolated that we just can't seem to get together to pool it to have like, you know, 10,000 patients. So you can really develop a really robust model that would have unique applicability across hospitals, you know, regions.
Yeah. I mean, this is an issue that I really tried to resolve myself. I worked through both the Society of Interventional Oncology and Interventional Radiology and tried to build together with a bunch of other people, Mike Solon and so many other smart people, the IO Core, the Interventional Oncology Clinical Outcome Registry. You know, we wrote a very sophisticated protocol just for liver cancer to, you know, collect 5,000 data sets to answer some very specific questions. At the end of the day, these data sets are extremely costly to obtain, not only because of the regulatory burden, but because of the governance component. Where do you store them? Who is in charge of them? Data sets and curated data sets are really large. So if you pay for storage, where are you going to store them? ACR is a possible host, but extremely expensive. And so we are stuck with the, you know, those institutional data sets. I mean, our institution is about like, you know, 2,000 HCC patients, roughly, well curated. I'm pretty sure that every large institution has similar data set. Just imagine if 10 of them are to get together.
Right?
You know, that is so frustrating for me, because I see so many of my attempts and studies and students that I have, they work on our data tirelessly, and frequently I see that it's just underpowered, but we would have significance and we would have better trained algorithms if we only have 10,000 patients and not just 2,000. So that's a huge issue, but I have no understanding yet how to resolve it. I mean, there would have to be a very concerted, very altruistic, society-driven effort to do that, or possibly legislation, which I don't think is going to actually come in the United States, given the very extensive laws protecting individual rights, which is a good thing. But I do think that some of the AI companies have slowly understood that, and they're moving to other sources for data, the large networks and, you know, private practice, private equity groups, and but also outside of the United States, you know. So, but I just unfortunately, for now, don't foresee high volume data registries being made available through our society pathways.
Yeah, maybe someday, maybe the medical AMA could you know, someday come out with some ability, like a huge registry that will be cross specialties. It'll be like one big repository for medical data, imaging, and hopefully, that'll be awesome.
I think that one interesting opportunity is the VA. The VA system has always been a very large
interconnected
interconnected database. Obviously the problem is that you know that there is very significant protections in place for veteran data. So I think if the government ultimately would make the decision to make some of this data securely anonymized and then make it available for research, that would be probably the single best curated database.
Yeah. My wife works at the VA. She's the chief of vascular surgery at here, the Loma Linda VA, and she's the head of the IRB. And we're talking about that. And she, you know, she sees that as like a really great opportunity to get in. But I totally agree. Interconnected already with the same computer system. You know, they're all like behind their own firewall. There's definitely a great possibility for that. Or you're right, maybe China, right? I mean, maybe they or some of these other countries where they don't have the same legal protections. I actually don't know, but I assume the research coming out of there, maybe like they have more collaborative efforts for sharing for research, medical research and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, right now, really, we have like a legislative issue. I mean, and it's actually in the United States, it's not as bad as it is in Europe, interestingly.
Oh, really? Interesting. Is that right?
Yeah, because right now the European Union, really, I would say, they thought they would enable, but in reality, they've stifled some of the AI research by really restrictive laws that have been put in place. And I mean, here, we really don't have that kind of legislation just yet, but I believe it's going to be coming. And as you can see, there is very extensive calls by lots of people to regulate AI more.
Sure.
And so, because we really don't know what some of it means, but I'm a firm believer in technology, and I think that we can engineer our way out of pretty much everything in the world. And so my hope is that eventually we will listen to the engineers.
that'll be awesome. So we have probably a lot of callers that might be listening, like, how do I get involved? If you were to like give your 2 cents on what you think the best way to get involved in AI research, how to start a program, what the tools you need, what you think would be the way a newbie could get started.
Don't do it alone. That's my first strong recommendation. Find a biomedical engineer, computer scientist, someone who really knows that end of the bargain and understands how to, you know, put data together and understands how to actually run code and what infrastructure it takes, and rely on your own expertise. I mean, we're physicians at the end of the day, right? And this is our major core training. And that is an expertise because we understand clinical data, we can curate it, and we also understand clinically unmet needs. That's a marriage in heaven, right? You bring someone who understands how to apply it and understands the use cases and, you know, ideally then can provide some interesting hypothesis-driven points to research on. And then you meet someone who is, you know, a computer scientist and engineer who knows the stuff. My recommendation is to try to learn the language of the biomedical engineer and computer scientist to sort of try to communicate with them in such a fashion that there is mutual understanding. But at the same time, what I would discourage probably is to just try to be everything yourself. Ultimately, that's impossible because I think that the algorithms are getting more and more complex. I mean, yes, there's off-the-shelf stuff, but I mean, the good stuff and the troubleshooting and the code is just so complex sometimes, and there are just so many possibilities for failure. You really need to team up with someone who knows. And at the same time, I very often see really cool mathematical solutions for problems that don't exist being published in biomedical engineering journals. And they seek our partnership even on an even playing field with, you know, equal terms and mutual respect. And I think that's the culture that we need to engage in. And if you're a trainee at a academic institution, there sure is a biomedical engineering department. Go there, find a partner, make a case, and then truly try to build that relationship, learn the language, and engage on that turn and at that level. I would not try to do it all by myself. And, you know, I personally haven't succeeded with that approach, and I don't think it's realistic. I mean, it's cool for a single, you know, SIR abstract. I'm pretty sure that it's easier right now to get accepted if you slap AI on it, but it doesn't really, you know, then evolve seriously into good grantsmanship and fundraising and serious work.
I don't know about you, but I feel like, so when we created our research team here at Loma Linda, like, I remember when I used to do research with our medical students, you know, who have been most of our coders for the most part. And we have some residents also involved in it. But like, I felt like the research that we did previously when I worked on different standard research clinical project, like looking at, you know, patient outcomes or image analysis. It was sort of like I could always tell them, okay, we have to do this. It was sort of like a very top-down approach. But I feel like now it's definitely very decentralized. Like the coders and our research, our, you know, our medical student, our resident research coders are very much even playing field when we discuss how the projects evolve. You know, there's definitely much more, I feel like it's not so much me telling them, oh, okay, you do you chart review this, you collect the data, we ran some p-value. Now it's definitely, I feel like when me and my wife work together with our team, it's so much more, we're relying on them just as much as they are relying on us to make the project work. Like, I feel like, is that like your experience too? Like, I feel like it's just a very different model when we're working with AI, because there's three or four different players that we meet every week and try to discuss that we're trying to troubleshoot, like, you know, all these different factors, in addition to maintain a relevant clinical question that will be applicable to a research presentation at a society meeting or something. And
yeah. And it's humbling, isn't it? I mean, we're trained in this medical world to cross these hierarchies from medical student to intern to resident to fellow to attending. Then you have like the hierarchies in academia. And then you're sitting with someone who is a grad student in biomedical engineering.
Yes, yes.
But this person is just on this particular topic, just so much smarter and differently talented than you are. And so you're just so exposed to actually not really knowing. And also it's a little scary because you don't really know what they're doing in the background.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you can only troubleshoot the code so much. I mean, you know, yes. I started learning about code. I started with R, Python, but I quickly realized that I'm never going to be able to learn that to an extent like a biomedical engineering student. So I stopped and I started relying on the experts. But what I'm going to say is that is a really cool experience. I mean, in my lab, I mean, some of the folks that started in my lab, I mean, one particular example, Clinton Wang, he's now an MIT graduate student. He's probably going to be graduating from his PhD at a very sophisticated MIT lab. And hell, this guy is so smart. I mean, so much smarter than I am in all questions related to math and data analysis, and just brilliant. I mean, absolutely, like, mind-blowingly brilliant. And so many of these folks are, you know, working with me. So, you know, again, to not cite too many folks, but Steve Jobs said that he doesn't want to be the smartest person in the room. He just wants to be surrounded by people who are way smarter. And that's a little bit sort of the entrepreneurial spirit in a laboratory like that, where you bring together folks who really know different things, and you just keep them focused on, you know, the clinical goal, the hypothesis driven research, and focus everybody on kind of like your mission. Mine, for example, is, you know, in liver cancer. So you just, you know, galvanize and energize these folks with the topic, and, you know, then everybody works towards the same goal, and it's worthwhile. But yeah, I completely agree with your experience. You know, we are no longer quote unquote top down in charge. Yeah. Those are partnerships, and this is fun also. You know, you stay fresh. You stay fresh in your mind and like crisp, and are challenged constantly with new concepts that you are not familiar with, that you didn't learn in school or residency.
Yeah. I feel also like within the last like 12 months, I feel like the interest in AI in the medical, I mean, I know the world is sort of just evolved into reality with ChatGPT and so many of the AI tools. And, you know, I don't know if you found this experience, but I remember like, three or four, when we started presenting our work 2 to 3 years ago, it was hard for us to get into societies and get our publications out there. Me and my wife, we were mostly working in the vascular surgery literature. But I feel like the medical community is now ready to open up everything to, you know, the AI world, and in the surgery world, it was still very much on the peripheral, like not standard registered data, not standard, you know, clinical outcomes analysis. And I feel like now there's a general interest, and I don't know if you feel the same way or, you know.
Very much so. I mean, I have an interesting story to tell. I think it was 2018. I think it was the SIO meeting. And we had our very first AI session. And after this session, someone senior came by and said like, well, okay, that sounds cool, but I think that's going to be a one-off. I don't see any, you know, significant research or applications sprawling in this. And then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, you see, you know, papers being cited 100 times a year, you know, with all this stuff. It's just really explosive. But trying to bring that to our field is not always easy. And I think it's going to take time to penetrate into the consciousness of interventional radiologists, simply because people who have been in charge the last decade, just aware and exposed to this, they didn't have expertise for this. And now slowly folks who are naturally interested in this are starting to come in, are starting to graduate, are starting to get engaged. You know, this year during the interview process for the match, what we saw is that much more applicants are actually putting that stuff on their CV and are saying, you know, I'm interested in this, or I'm a computer scientist and by first profession, that's why I want to go into IR. And you know, that's where the innovation is going to be coming, by people who are driven by that topic coming on to our specialty. And I think that's just a natural evolution. You know, that's cool. I mean, you know, IR didn't used to attract data scientists or computer scientists to join our ranks, but that has changed clearly. And I can tell you from the interview pool and all the people that matched, I mean, dear God, I mean, there are smart people around who are going to contribute really in major ways.
That's great. I mean, I think that just shows amazing potential for the future with the growing pool of talent in our field. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. One more question. So what do you think the biggest innovation you have seen in healthcare in your career?
So I have a particular career focus, obviously, liver cancer. I think that there are two things that are coming down the pipe that I believe are going to be transformational. You know, being the cancer molecular scientist and immunologist and all these kind of things that, you know, have captured my attention for the last couple of years. I think that the evolution of immunotherapy and the presence of immunotherapy has been recently really transforming the way how we care for our liver cancer patients. And that's going to be everywhere, also in combination with local regional therapies. That's basically one of the things that I believe is changing our landscape. But on a much bigger scale, I would say that generative AI is going to change the way we work. I mean, you see that now with, you know, ChatGPT-4, we have a lab subscription. That really is changing the way how we do science, how we source information, how we proofread, how we collect information for our PowerPoint presentations. That really is already impacting us on a day-to-day basis. But I do think that there will be very sophisticated applications of natural language processing-based generative AI that is going to help us write our notes, get all the information from Epic in the future, and really have a much better workflow in our interactions with patients, and also educate patients about diseases. So I think that in by itself is going to be a really significant driving force. It's going to be like the introduction of the PACS system for imaging. It made us so much more effective just by being able to use digital picture archiving. And I think with everything that is related to documentation, everything that frustrates us right now with the EMRs, the, you know, generative AI and natural language processing are going to be the next big evolution and make some aspects of our work obsolete, but they allow us to focus really on things that are more fun.
That sounds awesome. I mean, I think that's going to be great. And I think you're right. I think it's going to be so much interesting things in the future with AI, predictive AI, generative AI. I think that we're going to see an explosion of tech research and new information, new guidelines. I think it'll be amazing. Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. Again, Julius, thank you for joining us this morning. It was amazing having you. I think your information and knowledge will be really important for the future of AI in the IR space. I think our society could really benefit from having people like you push the boundaries of clinical care and medicine, especially in our field. I think it'd be amazing to see what kind of work you and your teams and everybody else in the society will be doing.
Thank you so much. It was great chatting with you.
That was Dr. Julius Shapiro, describing the increasing impact of AI on healthcare. We thank our host and guest for their time, and you for listening to Kinked Wire. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have any thoughts or ideas for us, drop us a line at kinkedwire@surwrap.org.